If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent.
Over the weekend, a CNN interview with former Attorney General Bill Barr went viral because in it, Barr performed one of the most spectacular capitulations to Donald Trump that we've seen from any Republican. Barr admitted that Trump probably talked privately about executing rivals as president, but shrugged it off, and meekly said nothing as CNN's Caitlin Collins quoted from a rant from Trump that belittled Barr in mercilessly humiliating terms. One person who immediately saw the larger importance of this is Amanda Carpenter, the prominent never-Trumper and an editor at Protect Democracy, who tweeted that it perfectly captures some essential truths about this fall's election. So we invited Carpenter on the show to discuss what this saga says about the GOP and its broader capitulation to MAGA. Welcome, Amanda.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me.
So to set the scene here, Bill Barr recently endorsed Trump, and then Trump responded with an insane rant on Truth Social, blasting Barr as weak, gutless, and lazy. Then, on CNN, Caitlin Collins asked Barr to respond to Trump's attack, and Barr meekly stood by his endorsement. Can you talk about this episode a bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising. This is part of the regular humiliation ritual that Donald Trump makes Republicans endure. But what I thought was really significant about this interview is that it was illustrative of how elite Republicans will justify their support for Donald Trump going into this election with the full knowledge of everything that happened, not only in his first term, but after January 6th and throughout all of these criminal trials.
Absolutely. And you get at a key thing there when you talk about the ritual humiliation that Republicans are required to go through. Let's talk about what Trump really said in his rant. What a lot of people missed was that Trump was also blasting Barr for not helping him steal the 2020 election. So what Trump was really saying here was, look at me, I humiliated Bill Barr for failing me, and now he's totally surrendered to me. So Trump is boasting that he has forced Barr to grovel and capitulate to him after Barr failed to help him steal the election. What is the broader role of humiliation and capitulation in MAGA politics?
Well, this is something that I think is not only indicative of Trump, but authoritarians broadly, in which they humiliate even the people who want to loyally serve them. But yeah, I think it's worth exploring, why is Bill Barr doing this? Because this does apply to the enablers of Trump, which in many ways is more interesting than what Donald Trump does to them. So what is Bill Barr getting out of this? There are a lot of types that you come across in Washington, which I do not think are representative of typical Republican voters, who go along with these types of things for what they themselves can get out of it. I always go back to the fact that Bill Barr, like, he is a Washington operator, right? I mean, he's served many administrations. He's, you know, in the muckety muck. He obviously was Trump's AG. But why did he break with Trump, right? Like, he did all the covering for the Mueller report, went out and spun that up, engaged in really gross obfuscation about the conclusions of the report, which was gross to watch, but effective. I think we do have to admit that, like, his handiwork there and being first to spin the conclusions to something that it wasn't was extremely effective.
He's very good at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a very good operator.
Yeah. He's a lawyer, but he is, you know, an operative too in many ways. And he, you saw him perform at that level at that time. But where he threw his hands up and walked away in December 2020 is when Trump came down on him personally, asking Bill Barr to go engage in drumming up these false investigations about voter fraud and everything that happened in 2020. That's when Bill Barr walked away. So for Trump's second term, Bill Barr is looking at opportunities again, right? Like there's reports where he's looking at doing some kind of competitor to the Chamber of Commerce. Like there's a lot of opportunities for people who can just be Trump adjacent, but not have to take the backlash personally. And what was a really interesting part of that interview is where Caitlin Collins, who, you know, I applaud her for a good job. You need to get these people to talk about their decisions. And he sat down for almost a full half hour. And she was pressing him on the idea of, well, were you there for conversations where he essentially was ordering the military to go kill people? And he sort of poo-pooed it and said, well, that's fine because, you know, we wouldn't let him do it. And that will not be the case in a second Trump administration. And so you kind of have to like push that focus of responsibility onto people, you know, voters, people who will work for him, that if you engage with him, you are essentially accomplice to the things that you know that he is capable of now. You know this based on his record. It's not speculation. It's not hypothetical. It is based on his past behavior and what he is promising to do.
I want to get to what a second term will look like in a second, but I also want to pick up on something you just said there. If I understand you correctly, and I think this is right, you're essentially saying that Barr was enlisted in Trump's criminal scheme, and that was something that Barr couldn't allow himself to get dragged into, and that was the point at which he kind of recoiled. And that's exactly right. And to your point, that shows that Barr knows exactly what sort of threat to democracy Trump poses, having been enlisted himself into the scheme, right? He knows that Trump has committed grave offenses against the country and that a second Trump term would be one of unchecked lawlessness. Yet here he is downgrading it and absurdly suggesting that Biden's policies pose a greater threat to the country. That set you off on Twitter. Can you talk about that? I mean, basically, his Barr's the most absurd thing that Barr said, perhaps aside from the execution stuff, which we'll also get to, is that, okay, yeah, maybe Trump did try to enlist me in a criminal scheme to overthrow democracy, but the real threat is the left.
Yeah, I mean, this is something you see come up a lot, you know, even just in my regular life. This is something I encounter. So I was not surprised to see Barr say it. But it was fascinating because when you see it presented in an interview in this fashion, it just becomes all the more absurd. And the idea is, well, I will vote for Trump because I don't like Biden's policies. Like he by his own, with his brilliant legal mind, legal training, the best argument he could come up with is that, well, the real threat to democracy is the border, clean energy regulations, as represented by regulating stovetops and things that are happening in classrooms across the country in terms of, you know, DEI and book bans, perhaps. He didn't really elaborate. He didn't really have much details. Like, but even if you, let's take that at face value, even if you take that at face value, those are normal, like typical policy discussions that would happen with any president. We had border debates with President Bush, Obama, Trump, you know, President Bush was campaigned on education back. Like these are typical issues that are handled in the normal scheme of things. But what Trump is representing is that he wants to dismantle the framework that we have in a democracy to resolve and debate those issues. You know, you can't have a policy debate when people are scaling the walls of the Capitol. That is just not how this works. And so to pretend as if somebody, you know, regulating clean energy and saying we should have lighter trucks to preserve fuel efficiency is the same thing as a former president's lawyer standing up in court and say, I have the legal capacity to execute my political enemies as president. I mean, those are just, they're not comparable subjects. And so I thought it was interesting and good that Barr sat for that interview so it could be presented so clearly, because that's actually like when we talk about the stakes, not the odds of the election, those are the stakes on their terms. That is what, when you travel in normal Republican circles, that argument is just kind of accepted as fact. It's not questioned. There's no pushback. And so even in just conversations I have with family members and things, I say, okay, yes, you may find these things upsetting. You may be worried about them, but these are normal policy disagreements. What Trump is asking you to accept is a dismantling of the framework to have elections where you can have those agreements. And I think that's been pretty successful.
Exactly. Barr is essentially trying to erase the very thing that's so abnormal about Trump and the MAGA movement, and just essentially trying to disappear it. At another moment in the CNN interview, Caitlin Collins asked Barr if he recalled Trump bringing up the idea of executing people who angered him, as you mentioned. So let's listen to this snippet.
But Alyssa Farah Griffin, who was Trump's communications director, posted yesterday and said that you were present at a moment when Trump suggested executing the person who leaked information that he went to the White House bunker when those George Floyd protests were happening outside the White House. Do you remember that?
I remember him being very mad about that. I actually don't remember him saying executing, but I wouldn't dispute it. You know, I mean, it doesn't sound, I mean, the president would lose his temper and say things like that. I doubt he would have actually carried it out.
Here you have Barr openly admitting that Trump talked about committing extraordinary abuses of power against opponents, that at a minimum, the idea deeply appeals to him. And critically, this is something you got at earlier, this isn't occurring in a vacuum. A lot of reporting is detailing that Trump and his allies are drawing up detailed plans for a second term that both consolidates executive power and finds new ways to unleash it on quote-unquote enemies of Trump and the MAGA movement far more effectively. So this isn't theoretical. Barr is endorsing Trump despite what he knows will be an extraordinarily grotesque and systemic set of abuses in his second term.
Yeah, I mean, and not only Bill Barr. I mean, there is a massive Republican conservative institutional infrastructure that is mobilizing behind these. I mean, honestly, these specific ideas in a way that, yeah, I came up through the conservative movement, worked for Jim DeMint, Ted Cruz, that is completely foreign, alienating, and unfamiliar to me. Bill Barr was questioned specifically about this idea in that interview, but we know this has come up in many instances, particularly with discussions about how he would police the border. Like Mark Esper and others have talked about, written in books about how Trump has said things, well, can't you just shoot them? Not only at the border, but also when it came to Black Lives Matter protests. Like, can't you just shoot them? That's kind of, I wouldn't say a common retort, but that's something that has been reported in several instances. So, his supporters will dismiss that as rhetoric. Correct. So that's just something he says. Even Bill Barr said that's just something he says. It wouldn't happen. That is not true, because when you look at the policies that people like are behind Project 2025 at Heritage, for example, they're specifically looking at how they can invoke the Insurrection Act on day one to mobilize against protesters. Trump has said in campaign rallies specifically that I will send the troops into these crime-ridden Democratic cities. I mean, there's kind of no pretense about would there be a riot or anything like this, and you can see how this could possibly blow up in a Trump 2.0, given the protests happening at college campuses with Gaza, and how that would be a pretext to do some pretty unforeseen, or I won't say unforeseen because you can see it happening, but things that we haven't encountered at the level before. But not only with the Insurrection Act, what I find particularly disturbing is the focus on how to marshal resources at the Department of Homeland Security, particularly with Border Patrol. Heritage has, they've got this big 900-page document. Trump has also spoken to this effect about how essentially the idea is that you would balloon resources inside Border Patrol, put National Guard there, like all these federal, like DHS has massive amounts of federal law enforcement resources. And so they're looking at, like, how can we just push those resources and troops into, the areas that we want using the president's discretion, no permission from Congress, no funding from Congress. Because, again, we have, I'm still a conservative, a very vast, bloated government that is ripe for abuse, particularly in these kind of homeland security situations. And they are zeroing in on that. So when Donald Trump says, can't you just shoot the protesters or immigrants, people said no in the first administration. You had people like Kristen Nielsen, Miles Taylor, Bill Barr, people who said no, but now they're specifically screening for people who will unflinchingly say yes.
It's so true and so important. I want to zero in on something you mentioned about the conservative movement, because I do think that in some sense, right, Barr's endorsement of Trump on the grounds that the left is a great threat is something that has been fairly common among conservatives for a long time, right? There's a streak of the conservative movement, and Barr is from it, that's long been comfortable with extremely expansive executive power, right? And so, yes, Trump engaged in lawbreaking that even Barr couldn't countenance, right? And yet now Barr is kind of continuing that conservative tradition in a sense, right? By using his stature to downplay that threat on the grounds that the left supposedly poses a massive threat. So to boil it down, Barr is fine with Trump's abuses on grounds that they're necessary to deal with the leftist enemy, and as long as Barr himself isn't legally exposed in the process. Is that unfair?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll just kind of brainstorm with you a little bit. I mean, what this reminds me of is sort of Bush-era, big government, Republican, unitary executive stuff that was justified, you know, post 9/11, that actually had a good amount of Tea Party style conservative backlash through the post Bush Obama years. But now it's being re-embraced, re-established. And part of the shift that I have seen and I have observed, just I would say post 2010, around the Obama time, is that there was almost a concession, especially among the social conservatives, that we are not going to be able to win on the issues anymore because of changing demographics, you know, self-imposed martyrism, what have you. There's a variety of reasons. And so we need to find ways to win by the barest possible margin with the Electoral College, and also, you know, just getting our judges on the court. So that is now our long-term strategy, right? Executive power in the judiciary. That has been really effective. And now Trump 2.0 is the vehicle to impose that big executive vision. And, you know, Donald Trump, I just think he's instinctually straight up authoritarian. He admires authoritarians. That is who he is. But, you know, again, I keep going to people at the Heritage Foundation just because they've articulated this vision to sort of shoehorn the best possible intellectual, and I'm using quotation marks for the people listening to this on podcast, intellectual framework in saying that, okay, we essentially need to purge the deep state because we need to impose this view of executive control where everyone is accountable to the president's agenda because he was elected by the people, and therefore he is entitled to not only just use the powers of the White House and his personal staff, but the entire federal government, right? And that is something new. I have not seen the conservative movement get behind that kind of vision where, okay, everyone from the EPA, FEC, DHS, DOD, whatever the president wants, because he was elected by the people, forget the Constitution, essentially. You have a responsibility to carry out his orders. And there's a new militancy that is that's really what's unrecognizable to me. So when Donald Trump is on the campaign trail, and he's kind of said this, there's a really good Washington Post mashup of all the times he says, I have Article 2 power to do whatever I want. These are the people coming in at a policy level to make that come true.
It sounds like you're saying that the conservative, that at least parts of the conservative movement seem to be fairly comfortably evolving into MAGA.
Yeah, although I think because this is so systemic, I think describing it as MAGA discounts the threat. I mean, this is authoritarianism. They're saying we don't really need to, we can win, we don't have to win the hearts and minds anymore. We just have to get that magic number and the Electoral College, screw the popular vote, get the White House, and then we're just going to muscle down our agenda in any way we see fit.
I'm fine with calling it authoritarianism or worse. I mean, the basic point I think that I'm hearing from you, and it's really, really interesting, is that in many ways, the parts of the conservative movement that Barr comes from are fairly comfortable evolving into an kind of explicit authoritarian politics.
That is what it seems like to me.
I want to get into a broader dynamic with the GOP and MAGA here. And by the way, I agree with you that MAGA is kind of a euphemism for authoritarian or quasi-fascist, to coin a phrase, politics. Pretty much everything you hear from leading Republicans about Trump right now sounds like what Barr did, right? It apologizes for or soft pedals or propagandizes away Trump's alleged crimes and his dangerously unhinged temperament, right? And you see MAGA leaders responding not by trying to meet Republicans halfway, say by admitting that some things Trump has done are wrong or possibly criminal or disqualifying, but instead by demanding continued fealty to Trump, a kind of continued capitulation to Trump that is absolute, right? And what is it like to be witnessing this as someone who has been kind of around the conservative movement for so long? It's kind of another way that conservatism is comfortably becoming Trumpism, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's, the phrase autocratic capture comes to mind. What I've seen, you know, with the conservative movement, and I'm talking, you know, like the nonprofits and things that are around Trump, like a Heritage, because that's the clearest example. And under that, there's like 70 other umbrella organizations. And so you get the idea. They see opportunity. And I guess if you want to give, I think it's helpful to describe, not to give people the benefit of the doubt, but describe why some people get so easily sucked into this. I mean, I know many people who understand Donald Trump is bad, but they say, or they tell themselves, okay, he's the nominee. If we're not there to steer something, to get some kind of policy win, you know, what are we doing? Like, we have to do something to help. And again, I'm using quotation marks. And so they go along with it. And then, you know, once you go along with the first term, you got to go along with the second term. That said, I think it's helpful and important to remember how much attrition there's been in the Republican Party. I mean, if you look at the people running right now, the fact that Laura Trump is RNC chair speaks to the lack of talent that is willing to put their name on the line for Trump for the third time. I mean, this is the third presidential election that he has been in the ballot. You look at what's been happening in the Republican primary, even though Nikki Haley isn't a candidate anymore, there's some states where she's still getting 10 to 20% in closed primaries. That is significant. But the damage long term, even if Trump gets blown out, right, there is still a party apparatus and infrastructure and voters who have come to embrace the idea that Trump and Trumpism is essential to winning any kind of Republican primary or election. I mean, the thing that why Nikki Haley has failed, why Chris Christie has failed, is that because they have failed to imagine a new kind of winning Republican coalition. It's all been about like, okay, well, how can I kind of be, even Ron DeSantis, how can I be MAGA-ish, but still not represent a threat to Trump, but beat him? I mean, that is an impossible task. Remaking the Republican Party, if it's ever going to happen, will involve remaking the coalition. And we don't know what that's going to look like, but it is going to be a very long-term project if it ever happens.
It's absolutely true that Trump has brought into the conservative coalition a certain type of low propensity, non-engaged voter who just wasn't there before. And I think when you see Kevin McCarthy make his pilgrimage down to Mar-a-Lago just after January 6th, or Lindsey Graham turning into a full-fledged kind of topic.
We talk about Christy Noem.
We could. If we had another hour, we could, yeah. But, you know, same with Lindsey Graham essentially becoming a full-fledged propagandist for Trump. They essentially came to understand that they needed this kind of voter that Trump brought into the process. And to your point about conservatives really recognizing all this opportunity in Trump, like including institutional, major institutional players in the conservative movement, it kind of brings us back to Trump's rant about Barr. His kind of boast about Barr's capitulation to him really captures something bigger, right? It captures the fact that large swaths of the conservative movement have eagerly allied with him, right?
Yeah, I guess it's making me think of, I don't know who had this quote about authoritarians, but the power of authoritarians doesn't come with telling the lie. It's getting people to repeat the lie that they know is a lie. That is the real power. And you saw that with Bill, you see it all over the place. I mean, even the people who know the election lies were lies. Look at all the people that have adopted this framework. I mean, even like a Brian Kemp or somewhere. Well, we need to preserve election integrity. Ron DeSantis spending $1 million in taxpayer money on election integrity units to go find fraud that wasn't there. That is the real power. These people know it's a lie, and yet they will still go along with it because they can't imagine a way to have a seat at the table or to have standing in the Republican Party if they don't do it.
Well, listen, Amanda Carpenter, thanks so much for talking this through with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler on the DSR Network.